This is Ron Orle, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited to be speaking today to Sean Donahue, a partner in Goodwin's capital markets practice and shareholder activism and takeover defense practice. He is chair of the firm's public company advisory practice and co-chair of Procter's ESG and impact practice. So thanks, Sean, for taking the time.
Yeah, great to be with you, Ron.
Okay. So let's start a bit with regulation. I know it's a subject that you've been thinking a lot about lately, as I have been thinking about lately. There's a variety of different things. The SEC under Gary Gensler has been extremely busy introducing new proposals almost weekly. And a lot of those measures will have an impact on activists, some intended and some, I suspect, maybe unintended, if they're adopted. We've got new 13D disclosure rules for when you cross 5% ownership. We have new derivatives disclosure proposals that are coming. But I thought we would talk about an actual rule that was adopted not too long ago that's supposed to take effect September 1st, which is the universal proxy card, which I would consider, and I bet you also, Sean, would consider one of the biggest changes to the proxy contest rules. I would argue since the SEC in the 1990s under Richard Breeden adopted the short slate director rule, so you could nominate a minority slate of directors. So anyways, the universal proxy card, in a nutshell for our listeners, gives institutional investors more flexibility to pick and choose incumbent and dissident director candidates on one card, a universal card. There's like a solicitation requirement for the dissident, but a lot of people, and I suspect you too, Sean, think that this is something that could encourage kind of a whole new category of activist investors, you know, to take advantage of the fact that the company, you can put your dissident director candidates on the company card and the company has to distribute it to a lot of people. So, and you, when we had chatted about the before, Sean, you had mentioned Herbert Denton of Providence Capital, a prolific activist from a couple of decades ago, an example of what we might see. So anyway, maybe you can tell us, you know, what do you think is going to happen with this universal proxy card rule once it comes into effect? And it sounds like you think that this will encourage a whole new wave of activists.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Ron. Thanks. And, you know, I like where you started with the old short slate rule. I was at the SEC in the 2000s, and it's one of the reasons I continue to sit in Washington, even though I have a somewhat of a New York-based practice. And, you know, the short slate rule comes out in 92. And then, you know, when I was at the SEC, there was debates about universal proxy, should they do it or not? And then they ended up adopting proxy access while I was there. And then that got struck down by the courts. Then we had private ordering around proxy access. And if you even look at universal proxy, got proposed in 16 and the rules finally going into effect 6 years later. So it's been a long road to having a universal proxy regime. As you stated, there is a 67% minimum solicitation requirement by the activist or dissident shareholder. So they do have to file a proxy. They have to give certain notice to the company. So they have hoops they have to jump through. But at the end of the day, we do believe that, you know, put aside the large activists, the Elliots, the Starboards, I don't think as far as proxy contest mechanics, it affects those guys that much. But if you look kind of downstream at second, third tier activists, or even activists who are more governance activists, or what some people refer to as gadflies, you could easily, in my view, either go to a 13F and pick the top 67% of shareholders, pull the 13F.
It's the 67% of shares, right? You don't have to find the... And so basically the top, you know, five or six shareholders could.
Correct. No, that's an excellent point, Ron. So you could mail to, if you got lucky, you might only have to mail to five or six. But likely you could look at the top 10, top 20, because it's 67% of the shares entitled to a vote in the direct election of directors. So that's exactly right. And you could go over to Kinko's or Office Depot, which is near my house, and print out your proxy statement that you filed on Edgar. Get the right addresses, stick them in the mail, and you've met the minimum solicitation requirement. Otherwise, the other thing you could do is you could use e-proxy. Now, activists have not historically, and so what we're talking about now is, could you do this inexpensively, and will that increase activism? So activists have not historically used e-proxy because the goal of a proxy contest is to win, and you want to do full set delivery, and ultimately, Costa Brava did one in the late 2000s. So it's been done before, but activists haven't done it. Now, e-proxy becomes where you only mail a one-page document to these shareholders and then just post your proxy statement online and say, go see the proxy. That becomes a lot easier and a lot more of a good solution, because the company, like you said, Ron, is essentially doing the work for you. They're going to mail a proxy statement. That proxy statement and proxy card is going to have your nominees on it. And as I think we'll get into, it may also have on it and is likely to have on it any stockholder proposals or proposals of business that you make because of how existing rules work under 14A4C, which is, to me, more relevant now that we have the ability to get the activists, well, not the ability, that the activist nominees will be on the company's card.
So explain to me, so you had this scenario you imagine where the activists will nominate some directors, maybe, you know, two or three directors, I don't know. But they also, I didn't realize this, they have a right to be able to include a number of shareholder proposals that they and you feel like they could use those as leverage along with their director candidates?
I do. And so once again, I mean, this is, you know, is it the McRitchies and the Chevedens and types of the world, but maybe not them, but people, as we talked about back in the 90s, there's a guy named Herbert Denton. There's been some others recently that are kind of solo activists, or they have smaller funds, like small, like, you know, 10 million bucks, 5 million bucks, not smaller like we would necessarily consider some of the other activists with less AUM. And could they essentially do things like the following? You propose one or two directors, maybe yourself, maybe a candidate with industry experience or something like that. And you also lob in to that advance notice of nomination a bunch of stockholder proposals. And there is no limit on the amount of stockholder proposals you can do in an advance notice. Now, under 14A8, which is the most commonly used stockholder proposal rule, that's where you have a stockholder proposal and put it in the company's proxy statement, you're limited to one per year. But if you're willing to file your own proxy statement, comply with the advance notice bylaws, you could do an unlimited amount of stockholder proposals. So I could definitely.
And then the company would have to include them on the company proxy statement too.
Yeah. So that is my view, Ron, that effectively, yes. So universal proxy, new rule 14A19, does not deal with proposals of business. Proposals of business, this was dealt with back in 98 under rule 14A4C. And 14A4C looks a lot like 14A19 in certain ways. It says if the shareholder meets three requirements, which is to say we intend to solicit, in this case, a majority, the requisite amount of shares to get the vote for the proposal. So they rep to that. They tell the company that. And then after they do it, they tell the company they did that. That effectively means that under 14A4C, the company cannot exercise discretionary authority. Therefore, they can't vote for that proposal one way or the other without putting it on their card. So what I'm saying is, given that the activist is already going to have to represent that they're going to solicit 67%, they're a fortiori going to represent that they're going to solicit a majority. And I think it becomes very difficult for a company not to include all those proposals on the card. Otherwise, you'd have a situation where you have two cards, and let's say the activist had four stockholder proposals. You'd have two cards, one card that has the company's nominees and the two dissident nominees in our hypothetical, the other card that has the company's nominees, the two dissident nominees, and the four proposals. I mean, what card is ISS and Glass Lewis going to recommend? So effectively, I think you're going to have to put these proposals on your proxy, which all goes back to final point is if governance activists or ESG activists or people that aren't regular activists or people that got $5 or $10 million under investment decide that they want to harass corporate America using universal proxy, I think there's a pretty easy way to do it if they could figure out how to do contests inexpensively, either use an e-proxy or, as I say, going down the street to Kinko's. And I think what that does, Ron, is that ultimately they may not have intention to truly follow through with the contest. And we can come back to that because you do actually have to have the intention to do it. But let's say they have enough intention that they don't violate 14A19. I think that's a lot of pressure on a company. Someone nominates themselves and a credible candidate. They have four or five ESG proposals that are the hot topics du jour, whether it's climate, whether it's, you know, give shareholders the right to call special meeting, whether it's social issues, racial equity audits, whatever it is, and puts a lot of pressure on companies all of a sudden to maybe give them a board seat and implement two or three of those proposals or find a mutually agreeable candidate. And, you know, in a lot of those situations, you could have a high amount of expense reimbursement potentially that doesn't necessarily always represent the true out-of-pocket cost.
Right. So basically, yeah, you have four proposals to distance, and then the four proposals add to the leverage in terms of negotiating a settlement. And, you know, we'll agree to remove these proposals if you add one of my two candidates, for example, to the board, and, you know, the company feels compelled to do that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think companies should be willing to kind of stare down an activist like that and say, look, like, we think we would win. And I do think when we were talking last time, I think ICON had not withdrawn Kroger's yet. So, I mean, this kind of theory of this ESG activism where you have a stockholder proposal coupled with the director slate, I mean, it was not particularly successful at McDonald's for ICON. He only got about 1.5% of the vote. And then that caused him to withdraw at Kroger. But, you know, as he cites in his McDonald's letter, those are high performing companies. And the other thing is, we all know these things are distracting. So who really wants to deal with, you know, company could be in a situation where the idea of dealing with even a gadfly governance activist, a solo activist, whatever you want to call them, a lower tier activist, dealing with them over a 4-month period and having them shine a spotlight on 4 or 5 stockholder proposals, all of which, by the way, they're going to pick things that ISS and Glass Lewis are going to recommend for, right? So even if you have, they don't like the activist and they think in our hypothetical, their other director nominee is not very good, they're still going to recommend for declassifying the board or certain ESG things that meet their policies, right? So you're still going to have all these proposals on your proxy statement. And maybe some companies don't care. I mean, Amazon had 15, 14A8 proposals this year, but some companies might. And it's
distracting. They didn't have a director contest to go with that.
Correct. And you just never know, right? I mean, also something that people don't talk about, and it is kind of a corner case, but there's still 130 companies, according to FactSet, in the U.S. with cumulative voting. Mm-hmm. And if you have cumulative voting and you have an annually elected board and you have, let's call it 9 or 10 seats, you only need 7% of the vote to get one person on. And so think about that, Ron. Think about, you target a company with cumulative voting that has poor corporate governance. You nominate yourself and one other person, and you're looking at only having to get between 7 and 15% to get one or two people on. Now, I'm not saying that the activists that you often write about, the name brand activists, are going to do any of this, but you can see that if somebody is thinking through governance issues and maybe historically had been a governance activist or had thought about doing activism, but found it to be cost prohibitive, or I don't know if I'll get traction, especially in the small to mid cap space. And once again, you know, one thing that Exxon proved is, you can look at ICON's thing and say that's one thing, but Exxon proves 0.02%. So,
right.
That is not a big ownership. And we know that 4 or 5 years ago, there was a fund VCM going around and basically buying 100 shares in companies and calling them up and saying, we're going to run a contest, we're going to run a fight. And they did eventually run a fight and they lost. But I just think there could be more of that activity at companies. And last thing I'll say on that, Ron, is that, yeah, you think it's going to be small to mid caps, but it could go up market because it could be perceived that it's not so much about the share ownership, but it's really about the issues that are being raised.
Okay. Just to drill down into one of the points you made, which was that the little activist fund engine number one with their 0.02% stake in ExxonMobil succeeded at getting directors with an ESG campaign there. One of the big things that supported them was that the big index fund supported at least some of their candidates, BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard. And I want to wrap in a bit of some recent development. BlackRock just recently expanded this program giving institutional investors, the key word is institutional investors, not retail investors, but institutional investor clients, the authority to vote their own shares. And it was interestingly, the announcement by BlackRock came just one day ahead of a Senate Banking Committee hearing that took place to consider this bill introduced by Republican Senator Dan Sullivan, seeking to prohibit BlackRock and other big index fund managers from voting on anything really, but shareholder proposals too, unless they receive specific voting instructions from underlying investors. And at the hearing, it became very clear that they wanted Sullivan's intention of this bill, even though it's kind of vague, is to have retail investors that are clients of BlackRock vote their share. So before we get into this bill, and you know, I don't think it has a very good chance of passing anytime soon, although it could wreak havoc, I think, on a lot of different things. But this thing that BlackRock is letting underlying clients they had like 47% of their index fund money. We're talking trillions and trillions of dollars are now being able to vote. By the way, the BlackRock put out a study that said that in the first 5 months of the existing pilot program, which was a smaller set of institutional investor clients of BlackRock, were given a chance to vote. They looked at U.S. pension funds and found that only 5% of U.S. pension funds with BlackRock capital elected to take ownership of their vote. But then they said a huge other amount, I don't know what it was, 30, 40%, are interested in learning more and are thinking about doing something like this. So I guess one question, I feel like BlackRock has not voted traditionally with activists. They supported that ESG contest at Engine Number One at Exxon. But giving the underlying investors the ability to vote, if this is taken up, you know, maybe coupled with universal proxy fund, do you think it'll have an impact or a change? Or what do you think might be the impact of this? Because they are the 800-pound gorilla of the investment world. You know, they're often the biggest shareholder of a company with 10% stake. So, you know, what does this mean, if anything?
Yeah. So I agree with you that BlackRock historically has voted with management and director election contests. They don't always, but they tend to. We tend to, when we do an initial vote, when the proxy solicitor puts together initial vote projection. And if BlackRock and Vanguard are in the cap table, we'll typically count them for us. It's not necessarily going to happen. And so the fact that those votes are kind of being pushed downstream and decentralized and not going to be in control of BlackRock, I think is on balance. You don't know that whether those institutions are going to support management. But at the end of the day, given that BlackRock in contests has historically done so, I think it's only going to give the activists even more of a potential advantage when it comes to voting at the ballot box. And it does bring up, Ron, your kind of other point is, look at the landscape here. We got dislocation and equity valuations. We have, you know, still trying to get back from COVID. We have universal proxy. We have cash on the sidelines where people do still have cash, funds do still have cash to deploy. You have ESG, you have universal proxy, you have decentralized BlackRock voting. To me, it's the perfect storm. I think universal proxy and ESG and all these other components is the perfect storm. And we've seen in the last 3 months, record levels of activist campaigns launched, not proxy fights, but campaigns launched. I think 2023 and perhaps the fall of 2022 even are going to be record years for activism because of all these, this confluence of factors.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that this could encourage more activism, this BlackRock letting the underlying clients, institutional clients, vote their shares. The legislation, okay, so I just want to be a hypothetical world. I mean, who knows if this legislation will ever come to fruition, but I don't know. I find it kind of ironic. The proponents of the legislation brought up this Engine Number One, Exxon, and how it was horrible that this little tiny investment fund got the big index fund support and were able to promote their sustainable campaign there. So this legislation, you know, they're trying to deal with this idea that if you have to go peel the underlying layers of investors and have the BlackRock clients, the underlying institutional investor client of BlackRock voted shares, but no, yet that client has to, you have to go down another level to the retail investor, you know, let's say, I don't know, CalSTRS, the actual teachers that are the investors in the California Teachers Retirement System. Get those teachers to actually vote too. You know, the underlying, or the, you know, any U.S. pension fund, the underlying retail investors vote. You won't get a lot of votes. And there's some situations where you know, there has to be a certain quorum of votes to pass a certain measure, like a merger. I don't know. So they have this thing of mirroring where they could mirror the votes that were already cast. They would mirror those votes. They basically double what votes is already cast if BlackRock did not vote a huge chunk of shares. My sense is that could also encourage the activist hedge. I just feel like this whole thing could encourage, you know, traditional activist hedge funds a lot. If, you know, BlackRock is less of its vote, you have this mirror voting thing. And I think one of the outcomes could be that there'll be less voting from BlackRock, which in turn means that the other votes, Carl Icahn's votes, shares have a higher impact, or active managers that often more support activists. I don't know if you had a chance to look at this legislation, but it just seems like they're trying to kill the activist hedge funds, the ESG ones, but they're maybe unleashing the Carl Icahns is the sense I'm getting.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And let's talk about more the, you know, we kind of started at the other end of the spectrum just because it's fun to talk about for universal proxy, because I do think you're going to see a bunch of new, smaller activists. But let's talk about the big guys, the you know, the Icahns, the Starboards, the Elliots, whatnot. I mean, I think they're between universal proxy, BlackRock, and their ability to kind of enter into a stock now and take at least toehold positions or start to build a position. And then the amount of pressure they can put on a company to get to a settlement quickly with universal proxy, I think is going to be pretty incredible. I mean, we saw years ago, after someone got to a settlement in 8 days, State Street jumped up and down and wasn't too excited.
Oh, right. I remember that.
Yeah, how quickly the settlement was done. But I just think it's a lot of pressure. You know, I mean, I'm totally willing to go into a boardroom and say, look, you know, you got somebody just nominated a short slate of three directors. We think you can win. We have voting projections from the solicitor. We think there's a path to victory. But I think it's going to be hard to say to that board that they might not get one. And I think when you say to the board, they're probably going to get one because of universal proxy, or there's a chance they could get one, and you hope they won't. You think you can beat them, but they might get one. Mm-hmm. I think the board all of a sudden starts to say, well, you know, if they're going to get one, do we really want to go through the cost and distraction? And if you're telling us, you know, proxy solicitor, that they might get, they nominated four of, you know, four of 11 or four of nine, but they might get two because of universal proxy. You can get a settlement done for us and just give them one or two seats. Why don't we get that done now so we don't have to go through the pain and agony? So even though I think you might see more campaigns, mm-hmm. I think ultimately the leverage that the activists have because of universal proxy to get to a settlement, you could ultimately see more settlements and perhaps even quicker settlements, which we were seeing a few years ago before people decided to do more fights, given the recent success of companies in fights.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So there's a few other kind of regulatory issues that are happening. I wanted to kind of get into one of the subjects is obviously the deal we care a lot about, which is M&A. And I found that even though when they don't admit it, M&A is an important goal for activists. I suspect that they have all these operational balance sheet stock buyback goals that they put out, but they really secretly wanted to see the company sold or a division divested. You know, in some cases, it's a very public agenda item for them, like we saw with McCallum at Kohl's. And we saw there's a Third Point has a campaign at a DSPAC new that he wants to have a sell. So, you know, sometimes it's an obvious campaign point of it. So I guess one, do you agree with me that it's often a hidden agenda item? And then in other cases, obviously it's not a hidden agenda. It's a key agenda. And I'm just curious, with the current market climate, the macroeconomic situation, will activists be able to continue to push this kind of strategy? Will it work at all?
Yeah. So, Ron, first off, I totally agree with you. I think going back to 1978, when Icahn, you know, launched his first campaign at TAP, and all the way to today, M&A is always a thesis and always a goal of almost every activist investor. Yeah, there might be some financial reengineering, but just think about it. At the end of the day, if you can get the company sold for a 30 to 40% premium after you took a sizable position in the stock, it has always been and remains today and will continue to remain the easiest way to quickly unlock value from your investment. So yes, I think any activist, and rightfully so, frankly, I don't fault them for that, even as somebody who only advises public companies and isn't on the activist side, I think that's the simplest way to unlock value, and it unlocks the most value. So I think M&A is always an underlying thesis. I think one of the things we've seen in the last year or two that we hadn't seen before is, put an Icahn aside, is a lot of other smaller funds actually making bids for companies. And I think that kind of, what do you want to call it, the confluence of private equity and activism.
So you mean like hostile or unsolicited bids?
Yeah, in connection with their activist campaign, correct. Right. So not necessarily launching a hostile, but instead of what we would see, maybe I'd say in most of the 2010s, which was you come in and you say the company should be sold, the company should be sold. Now some funds are adding the company should be sold and, hey, I'll give you $30. Company should be sold. I mean, we had that in the, I defended Aptivo Therapeutics in 2020. We got the activist there, made a bid for the company. You had other situations. Turtle Beach, Donna Rail made a bid. So you've seen a lot of them where smaller activists have made a bid for the company. And that is kind of a new thing. And do they really want to buy the company? I don't know. Is it a new way to put them in play? But my point is, it only goes to your theory that M&A to me is almost always in the back of the activist's head when they're running a campaign, because it's the easiest way to unlock a lot of value if you can get the company sold at a premium over a short period of time.
Funny you should mention unsolicited bids or bids that are from activists. And I'm actually just was emailing back and forth with this Dubai-based unsolicited bidder for a Canadian-US biotech company, about 350 million market cap. And the investor keeps trying to portray themselves as like a private equity fund. But my investigation suggests that they're not. They've never made an unsolicited bid before. And it's not clear to me that they own any portfolio companies. And I'm trying to get a copy of some letter of financing from a bulge bracket bank. And, you know, I haven't got that yet. So, Sean, are you suggesting that with the current market condition, we might see more unsolicited bids, you know, something companies
should there are more unsolicited bids. They may not make it to the deal, but there's more unsolicited bids. Private equity has a bunch of cash on the sidelines. They're being very aggressive in the market, and they know a deal when they see one. And at the end of the day, there's tons of companies right now that are trading well below their intrinsic value because of the dislocation in the market. And so you're absolutely going to see more unsolicited bids. Whether you see true hostiles, I don't know. I mean, we've had an uptick in hostiles and true hostile takeovers where someone either files a Schedule TO for cash or Schedule TO in an S-4 and an exchange offer where it's cash and stock if it's a strategic. I mean, we've seen more hostiles, but do I think we're going to see a lot more hostiles? I mean, they're fun to defend against, right? I mean, you kind of have the JetBlue situation is kind of a quasi-hostile, but it's a little bit odd in the sense that how kind of it got structured with the 251H vote. But yes, you're definitely going to see more unsolicited bids. I think you're definitely going to see more M&A activity as far as private equity with cash on the sidelines. You see more take privates. I mean, whether you see these large strategic to strategic, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. I mean, and just to wrap up here, I feel like, you know, just to bring the activists, you know, the activists may try to encourage, just like they did in a boom market, private equity to come in and buy a strategic. If they can acquire shares and then the share price doesn't drop drastically after they accumulate their position. But I wonder, so that it's kind of when you have these unsolicited bids, not hostile bids, does it put the companies in a difficult position? Do they have to run an auction process? You know, I've been hearing that in the tech space, for example, there's been some auctions that failed. You know, is there a stigma associated with that? You know, they try to keep it secret, but then maybe the activist finds out. So, I mean, I guess you agree with me. There's a failed auction, you know, even if it's private, will it remain private always? You know, I feel like the activists are good at finding that out. And that's something that they often, and obviously they're not going to push for sale after a failed auction, but I feel like they could use that as leverage to drive other changes, you know, operational changes, SG&A changes, that kind of thing. I don't know. What do you think? Is it a problem to have a failed auction?
Yeah, I mean, if you've tried to sell the company for a premium, I mean, obviously, and that comes out into the marketplace. Yeah, I think at that point, it can give somebody a talking point around that. I mean, a question, when do you actually run an auction, whether it's the right time to do that? You know, you get an unsolicited bid. Does that cause you to run an auction? You know, those are all questions that kind of get discussed at a boardroom when the unsolicited bid comes in. I think what's interesting now in the market, Ron, is just the premium you see to the 30-day VWAP or whatever the premium of the offer is tracked to. Just it looks like a significant premium because you may have dislocation in the market and the stock may be undervalued, but you got to start to look at things like 52-week highs. You know, there's a lot of ways be able to reject a bid for other reasons given the dislocation of the market. But it's a hard argument, right? It's hard. You get an all cash offer and, you know, the banker comes in and you're evaluating it as the lawyer and the banker with the board. And it's a nice premium over the 30-day trailing average. It's kind of hard to reject. And if somebody goes and does a public bear hug, it becomes even more difficult.
Yeah. You know, you just have to keep an eye out for when these are these hedge funds that have no portfolio, that have no financing. And, you know, I see those also, right? You know, I see credible hostile bids and then I see ones that I have to be careful and flag as not really credible ones. But okay, we are out of time, Sean. Thank you so much for taking the time. This has been the Activist Investor Today podcast with Ron Orl, and you've been listening to Sean Donahue, partner at Goodwin's Capital Markets and Shelter Activism and a Takeover Defense Practice. Thanks, Sean, for taking the time.
Thanks, Ron. Great to be with you.